Off in the salty ocean, off where the waves roll free. The sparkling water rises, then crashes to the sea. Out amongst the breakers, you'll have no need to fear. It's true, it's the blue frontier.
Welcome to Rising Tide, the Ocean Podcast. This is David Helvarg, and as always, my co-host is Vicki Nichols Goldstein of the Inland Ocean Coalition.
Hello, everyone, and I hope you are having a fantastic day.
And today we're happy to welcome an old friend of mine, Jeremy Rifkin. Jeremy's what in the U.S. they call a gadfly or iconoclast, and in the rest of the world, a public intellectual. He's written 23 books that have been translated into 35 languages. Among some of his bestsellers, he's critiqued genetic engineering, the cattle beef industry, promoted hydrogen energy, and in his book, The Third Industrial Revolution, proposed a pathway beyond fossil fuels to a clean energy future. As a result, he's now a major climate advisor to both the EU and China. Plus, he advised Senator Chuck Schumer on the bipartisan infrastructure bill that Congress finally passed a few years ago. In his latest work, Planet Aqua, Jeremy's gotten down to basics, the very basic source of life on Earth, water, what it means to live on a water planet. So, Jeremy, as Vicki and I are both big promoters of the 97% of the world's water that's salty, I'm curious what got you from your last book, The Age of Resilience, about rewilding Earth, to thinking and then writing about our blue water planet, what you call Planet Aqua.
First, it's a pleasure to be with you. Here's where I think the problem is. We've really basically misjudged the nature of the planet we live on for a long time. And that's what's taken us to the crisis we're now facing. We have long believed that we live on a land planet, verdant and green. And as you know, because we're old enough to remember this, that was shaken back in December of 1972 when the Apollo astronauts were heading to the moon. So one of the astronauts had a home camera. As they were heading right to the moon, he turned around and did a quick photo of our planet from space. It shocked our generation. We thought we would see a beautiful green planet in all the verdant shades of green. We saw a blue planet with all the shades of blue with only a veneer of green, the blue marble. And that was a real wake-up call. But the realization that we're in a water planet changes everything in terms of how we think and act in the future. So I think that's the beginning of what this book was all about. Here's the problem very centrally, which is never discussed. And that is that about 200 years ago, we began an experiment and we decided to change our energy regime from burning trees and peat, et cetera, for energy to going beneath the ground and digging up the burial grounds of a previous period of history, the Carboniferous era. We exhumed the dead bodies of plant and animal life that had morphed into coal, oil, and gas. We took them out of the ground and we created the fossil fuel based industrial civilization, the age of progress. Here's the problem. It's very simple. We have spewed massive amounts of these fossil fuels into the atmosphere, and they're blocking the sun's heat from getting off the earth. CO2, methane, nitrous oxide. So for every 1 degree Celsius that the temperature on the planet goes up because of global warming emissions in the atmosphere, the hydrosphere is sucking up 7% more precipitation from the ground. So we're getting 7% more precipitation from the oceans. That's the biggest part of it. And then from the rivers and the lakes and the streams. And then from the soil and the lithosphere and from the plants and the trees. So more precipitation is evaporating more quickly into the clouds. And we're getting extreme water events. These massive atmospheric rivers in the winter pouring snow into places that never had snow before. We're getting flooding across every continent, every ecoregion, wiping out ecosystems and destroying our habitats. And then after the floods, we're getting the droughts for month after month, no water whatsoever. Then the heat waves come, 100 degrees, 110, 120, 125 degrees Fahrenheit. Then we get the wildfires. And then we get the hurricanes.
So we need to get people to start thinking of this as a water planet. And are you having success with your book to actually get people to start thinking in that way? Because you have to understand that it is a water planet in order for us to make the shifts that you're recommending that we'll talk about in your book.
Well, back in 2001, Romano Prodi came to the D.C. He was the president of the European Commission at that time and formerly prime minister of Italy. He sat me down in the embassy, held my hand for 25 minutes. I knew I was in trouble. He wouldn't let go. And he said, look, you spent 25 years in America. It's not moving on this issue. Come to Europe. We will lead. I took him up on it. I commuted for all these years, the last four presidents, the current president. We did something really interesting. We asked an anthropological question. We said, forget the whole playbook. The playbook we're using to deal with this crisis created it. The Enlightenment, the Age of Progress, the Industrial Revolution, how we approach nature, the way we relate to scientific inquiry, how we educate our kids, the economic systems we develop. All of that playbook of the Industrial Age, the Age of Progress, has taken us to an extinction event. So how can we use that playbook to try to answer the question? So then it led to the idea, how do the great paradigm shifts in history occur? That's the question we asked. It was an anthropological question. Throw out everything. How did they occur? What we found was fascinating, that when you look at history for at least the last 6,000 years, all the great paradigm shifts, and there haven't been that many, had the same common denominators. That in a moment of time, five defining technologies emerged rather serendipitously across a region and converge to create an infrastructure that fundamentally changes our day-to-day lives. What are they? Number one, new communication revolutions. Number two, new energy regimes. Number three, new modes of mobility and logistics. Number four, new ways of organizing water, and the water part manages the other three. And number five, new ways to address habitats.
Let's go right to the water part, because as you were saying earlier, there's more moisture in the atmosphere, which means less stability. We've been burning fossil fuels, as you say. We've been burning ancient living life and throwing the whole water system out of whack. So how has hydrology changed civilizations and the way we look at civilization?
So this all started 6,000 years ago in Mesopotamia. We began to move from nomadic life to sedentary life. We began to deal with agriculture and pastoralization, and then the big change happened. In Mesopotamia was the beginning of what we call urban hydraulic civilization. They sequestered the hydrosphere. They put in dams and dikes and levees and reservoirs so they could begin to sequester the water planet for the use of one species. It happened at the same time in the Indus Valley of India with their rivers, and the Yangtze and Yellow River in China and their rivers. Later, the Kumer civilization in Asia, Greece, Crete, and of course, the Roman Empire with the aqueducts. And then ended up in the Americas with the Mayan civilization in Central America and Mexico and the Inca civilization. When it all ended?
And the Tiwanakans.
Yeah, it ended with the great hydroelectric power dam, starting with the Hoover Dam and Lake Mead, all the way to Three Gorges. And now it's all collapsing in real time because the hydrosphere is changing the whole plan. It makes no difference what we want to do. The hydrosphere is determining the new ecosystems. The hydrosphere is determining how we will distribute our species. The hydrosphere will be determining all of this. So the question is, will we begin to understand that instead of sequestering the hydrosphere for our species, which doesn't work, it's always collapsed through history, we have to now adapt our species to the hydrosphere on a water planet. It's a completely new paradigm.
And so tell us, how would that look? Because we've lived for, like you said, 6,000 years controlling water, and now you're saying that it is going to come in and control us.
So let me talk about what the new paradigm would look like, the infrastructure. Remember I said new infrastructures are communication revolutions, new energy regimes, new mobility and logistics, new ways of organizing water, which manages the others, and then the new habitats. So these infrastructure revolutions are giant social organisms that allow us to bring large numbers of our species together as a living, if you will, social experiment. What's happening now, I'll give you a couple examples. First Industrial Revolution, Britain in the 19th century. The Communication Revolution, steam power printing and the telegraph. The Energy Revolution, coal. No more peat, no more burning forest. They'd already depleted the forest, coal. The Mobility Revolution, they put in a railroad with a steam engine. The Water Revolution, they were the first since the fall of Rome to put in modern water systems for purification and sewage. The habitat solution, urban development with railroads, urban development. That took us to national governments. It took us to national markets. It took us to shareholding companies, et cetera. Second Industrial Revolution in the U.S., 20th century. The communication revolution was the telephone, got the whole continent connected as in real time. The energy revolution was oil. We struck oil in Texas. We didn't need coal as the primary source. The mobility revolution was the automobile. And the water revolution was the great electric hydroelectric power dams, et cetera. And the building revolution was suburban life with interstate highways. That took us to globalization, global markets, the whole works. And that all collapsed in 2008. That was the change. What's happening now is a third industrial revolution. The communication revolution is the internet. We got 4.5 billion people with cell phones in their hand. And at a near zero marginal cost, they have more computing power than sent our astronauts to the moon. That's number one. Distributed. Keep that word in mind. The second is energy. We now have millions and millions of people producing their own solar and wind and harvesting it in their businesses and their communities and their neighborhoods. It's all distributed. You can't centralize it. The mobility revolution is electric and fuel cell transport powered by solar and wind from the electricity internet and using big data and analytics so they can be autonomous. The final revolution is the water. And that's happening now, water microgrids. People are confused. They don't understand why it's floods, then droughts, then floods. Which one is it? It's both. Water molecules do not disappear. They've been here for billions of years. They just change when they're coming down and in what volume and where they go. So water microgrids are now coming in. There's going to be hundreds of millions of water microgrids on top of roofs everywhere. And they're going to be smart, digital, where you can keep the water underground and then distribute it when you need it across communities, not decentralized. And the final thing on this is the changes in habitats, and that's where 3D printing is coming in. We're now 3D printing buildings with a different type of manufacturing. So this is what takes us into a different economic model. This revolution requires a shift in how we understand in economic development. The first and second industrial revolutions were centralized because of fossil fuels. And because they were so expensive, they required a huge amount of financing and shareholding companies had to come in. And every industry that follows fossil fuels, because they're all related to it, have to be centralized with a handful of big players and the rest doing the little stuff. What's happening now with the third industrial revolution, because it's all distributed, you're starting to see this now. It's called additive manufacturing. Now, subtractive manufacturing was the first and second industrial revolutions. What we do is you take a big hunk of material from the planet, more than you need, and then you whittle it down and you leave some of it away because you don't need it. Like if you're making a house, some of the cement isn't used. Some of the wood isn't used. If you're making a car, some of the machinery isn't used. So what happens here is that it creates a centralized model. But 3D printing is what we call additive manufacturing, totally different. And that is you can take a feedstock. Let's use clay. Clay is what we use for buildings for thousands, hundreds of thousands of years. So there's an architect in Italy, Cucinella. He uses clay. And the software tells the clay how to build out an entire building in 24 hours. And then here's the difference. With additive manufacturing, you can go from a seller, buyer, market, and a capitalist system to a provider, user, network in this new distributed economic system. He can take the instructions for that building, and he can take his little cell phone at near zero marginal cost and a provider, user, network, and send those software instructions to a Philippines architect in the Philippines, and she can build out as many buildings as she likes and pay a license fee. We're heading from globalization to glocalization. And we're heading to bioregional governance, and we're heading to high-tech SMEs all over the world. That's what's really happening in real time. And everything I'm saying here is starting to scale. It just isn't being discussed in the environmental community.
So, Jeremy, the question is, with the warming that we already have, moisture is increasing the atmosphere, we're going to have more flooding and droughts, and how do you build a solution within this larger disaster we're now living in?
We're going to have to move, as I said, from globalization to glocalization. That's the new additive manufacturing. It's a big deal. There's billions being spent on it. But we also...
Say that again. I like that. Glocalization?
Glocalization. Because with this distributed technology, all of it's owned by everybody. If you have solar and wind, you're the infrastructure. If you have a cell phone for communication, you're the infrastructure. If you have electric vehicle, you're the infrastructure. You have edge data centers, you're the infrastructure. If you have a 3D printed building to live in, you're the infrastructure. So what's happening is we're seeing a shift to bioregional governance. Bioregional governance. That's what everyone's worried now, because they see this whole geopolitical battle going on in the world, but they don't realize it's an end game. It's over, because the new technology is here now and it's cheaper, but it creates a more distributed system. So what's bioregional governance? Here's what it is. Climate disasters don't give a crap about sovereign national boundaries. The floods, the droughts, the heat waves, the wildfires, they affect specific ecosystems. So what's happening is they're beginning to create bioregional governances. You don't give up nation states, but you extend it across political boundaries so that shared ecosystems can work together across political boundaries to prepare, rescue, and restore. This takes us to a more distributed governance, where you have to move from geopolitics to biosphere politics and bioregional governance. It's all about water. It's all about water. Now, I'm just not sure we'll get there in time. All the technology is there and the market's ready.
Do you love the salty characters and ocean champions we have on The Rising Tide? So do we, and we're dedicated to bringing inspiring stories and voices that make waves. But here's the catch. We need your support to keep the tide rolling. A tax-deductible donation at bluefront.org will help keep The Rising Tide on the air and online. If you're ready and able to amplify these salty voices for the sea, dive in with a donation, big or small. Visit bluefront.org and join the movement. And now, back to the show.
In your book, you describe a lot of these activities happening, climate change, these large floods. When do you feel like these systems are actually going to be shifting the consciousness of people and we will start actually implementing this? You just said the environmental community isn't really cued into this. So I'm trying to get a sense. Are we looking at 10 years out, 50 years out? Give us a time.
It's happening right now in this hour. There's a new movement called the Blue Deal to go with the Green Deal. The Economic and Social Committee of Europe, which represents every major industry and trade association in the European Union, and I would like all my friends to know, the EU is the second largest economy in the world. China's third. GDP, U.S. one, really close, U.S. two is EU. So independently, they're calling for a Blue Deal. And then the Committee of the Regions of the EU said, we want a Blue Deal. And now in the Parliament, they're discussing a Blue Deal. So we're moving toward this. And Europe has led at every step. We led with the hydrogen economy, led with the Green Deal, moving.
In terms of existing water infrastructure, dams, canals, aging wastewater treatment,
bridges,
coastal development, how is the Blue New Deal addressing this massive existing infrastructure, and how is the transition going to take place?
Hydrogen's already dealt with it. We can talk about how we can control this and we can manage this. That's what everyone's into. It's not happening. The hydrosphere is rewilding. The hydrosphere is determining where the waters will come, where the ecosystems will be, how our fellow creatures and our species will migrate. We have to adapt. Rather than controlling the waters, we have to adapt to the hydrosphere on this planet, and it has to be a more sophisticated technological, economic, and social shift in history. This isn't going back in time. It's going forward in time.
What kind of radical shift need to align for people to get this? Do we have to wait until the disasters have hit us to be synced up with the technology? It seems like there are so many moving parts to really get our head around the fact that water is going to be dominating us versus the other. And you've given us a lot of examples happening internationally. But I'm very concerned because in the United States, I don't think people are paying attention to this. How do we get the U.S. to wake up and start making these shifts so people can be more open to all of the recommendations and more aware of what's happening in neighborhoods and cities and communities?
The U.S., it's interesting. Let me give you an example of the people I'm really thinking of. Back years ago, the city of San Antonio, which is the sixth largest city in the United States, and they have the largest public utility, CPS. It's huge. they asked my team to come in and work with them on their future energy for Texas. And they were looking at nuclear and wind. And we, our engineers and scientists came in because we're not political. It's all apolitical. It has to do with the technology because we've done center-right governments and center-left regions with them because you have to have the regions participating. That's the key. So we said, if you go nuclear, you may be overrun. And if your billions overrun, you could bankrupt the city. Unbeknownst to the board of directors of the utility at that time, their acting CEO knew they were $4 billion overrun. They got out with a billion loss, and we put them in wind. Then the wind went all through Texas and through the prairie states. They're all in the agricultural states, all the major sun and wind. The electric 150 truck, General Motors, electric, it's in Kentucky and Tennessee, and the governments have given them everything they need. This is happening all over the country. It's primarily, you're going to see, it's the more agricultural states there where this new paradigm will emerge, at least in the states. You asked about what's the paradigm, the hopeful paradigm shift. Let me give you some thoughts about that, all right, for just a moment.
Thank
First
you.
Of all, there's three studies that are really interesting. There's a plan by the National Institute of Health. I'm looking out my window. I'm at the Bethesda quarter, high-tech quarter. There's the Naval Hospital and NIH. They have something called the Human Microbiome Project. It's changing everything, but no one seems to know it because it's not understood. What they're telling us at the NIH, and now it's spread to Europe, Korea, and China, and Japan, that every human being on this planet and every organism on this planet is literally an ecosystem. This is not just a cute thing. It's literally an ecosystem. Our human skeleton is replaced every 10 years. And much of the elements that come from our body come from the rocks and the mountains. So the waters, they weather the mountains. And when the waters weather the mountains, it moves the elements into the sediment. And then the elements from the mountains that are in the sediment go into the plants and animals, then into our body. This is phosphorus in my tooth. It came from a mountain. It's not going to be here. It's going to go.
Came from my backyard in Colorado.
There you go. So then the interesting thing is that, so we take in water molecules and they're in every cell. They're 60% of the adult body. They manage a lot of the electromagnetic fields and everything else. Then those water molecules go somewhere else. They never disappear. And then you have, and of course, without the hydrosphere, you don't have the atmosphere because most of the oxygen comes from phytoplankton. And without the hydrosphere, you don't have the biosphere. So it's a water plant. It's a water plant. Now, here's the deal with the human microbiome. It's really interesting. We're not alone in our body. This is what every kid needs to know when they have their first biology class. It turns out that only 44% of the cells in the human body are human. The other 56% belong to all sorts of other creatures, millions of them in our body. The proteus, the fungi, the bacteria, the archaea, the viruses. There's only 20,000 human genes in the human body. Watson and Crick just got a teeny bit of it. There are millions of other genes in the body, and they're all working with each other in various ways in all of these cells to maintain each of us as an ecosystem. So we are both bringing in the planet to us. We're bringing in the elements from the mountains. We're bringing in the water molecules. We're bringing in the oxygen from the atmosphere, from the waters. It's all happening.
And microplastics.
And microplastics, unfortunately. But what would happen if a little child said to their mommy or daddy when they're 5 years old, "Mom and Dad, what is this place we live in? What is this?" And mom and dad says to their little five-year-old, "Sweetie, you live on a water planet. This is planet Aqua." That would change the entire paradigm. What would happen if around fifth grade or sixth grade, the biology teacher would say to them, "You are an ecosystem. This is not just a metaphor. And all these ecosystems are at every moment working with other parts of the planet, the hydrosphere, lithosphere, atmosphere, to maintain a living neo-animist organism. It's the real." And this is not me. I just categorically put together what we've seen the last 30 years. Some of them great physicists, the scientists, the biologists, the chemists. But this is not a paradigm. So what we're getting is environmental groups, their first reaction and governments is, "Let's take a pilot project and let's try to deal with this dam, or let's try to deal with this particular crisis."
Sand, whatever.
All of that has to happen. But with the new paradigm, it gives us hope that there's a future. The last thing I would say about this is the Gen Z demonstrations were very interesting to me. When all the Friday for Future kids came out on high schools six or seven times, 41 countries, 141 countries, millions of them, I didn't quite understand it until I met with three of them in Milan, these young teenagers. This wasn't like any protest in history. David, you and I go way back to the Boston Auto Party in 1973, all right? So these were different. There have been protests all through history. That's the kind of speech. We're a protesting species, actually. But this was different. This is the first time an entire generation across the planet in 141 countries came out on the streets, and they saw themselves as an endangered species. And they saw their fellow creatures as part of their evolutionary family. All the other divisions are still there. Our national loyalties, our government ties, our religious affiliations, tribal or blood ties. But there's never been a point where an entire generation saw themselves as an endangered species and their fellow creatures as part of the family. When that little koala bear was taken off that tree in Australia that was on fire, every young person in the world was in tears, and old person too. So this book, I don't know how we get people to take a look at it because people don't read, the younger generation isn't reading, but it's frustrating in one way and hopeful in another because everything I'm saying is it didn't come from me. There's 148 footnotes in this book, and they're all from studies and journals. They're not just somebody
making it up during a State of the Union.
Yeah, whatever it is. So what I'm saying is this is a completely new paradigm for the planet, and it's already market-wise. The frustration is you have old interests and old codes, regulations, and standards and old ways of thinking the playbook. We need a new worldview to go with this. And the worldview would be a worldview to understand that we are a water planet and pretty unique in the universe.
What I loved about your book, you took us through the history. You really showed us that we have to recognize that we are on a water planet. There's no moving around that. And I'm hoping with this message, with many of the interviews that you're doing, with the distribution of your books, that people really start understanding what you're trying to share. And I think there is that sense of hope. Like we just can't fight it. We have to engage in it, recognize it, and be part of it. And with that, thank you, Jeremy Rifkin, author of Planet Agua, and many other books, for joining us on the Rising Tide Ocean Podcast.
Thank you very much. I hope Planet Agua becomes a brand all over the world. It will change the paradigm. It will allow us to relearn how to live in this amazing, maybe unique planet, water planet in the universe for eons to come. That's my hope.
Thank you for joining us on the Rising Tide Ocean Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and leave us a review or share it with your friends and other ocean lovers. Follow us on Instagram and visit bluefront.org for more updates and additional resources. Rising Tide is a production of Blue Frontier, co-hosted by David Helbart and me, Vicki Nichols Goldstein of the Inland Ocean Coalition, with production support from Holden Hardcastle of Fluid Studios, Natasha Benjamin, Kelly Bates, and Nick Paz, and editing services provided by Charles Landon of Studio Cape May. Thanks for listening, and until next time, stay hopeful and stay salty.
Off in the salty ocean, off where the waves roll free, the sparkling water rises, then crashes to the sea. Out amongst the breakers, you'll have no need to fear. It's true, it's the blue frontier. Tear, tear. Off in the salty ocean, off to the blue frontier.
Sparky, come here, buddy. Sparky! There you are, good boy, Sparky!